Strange studies of strange stories.
Welcome, dearies, to the Strange Studies of Strange Stories feedback show.
We're here on Patreon talking about your comments on our shows for December of last year when we discussed some fairy tales by the Brothers Grimm.
I'm Chad Pfeiffer. He's Chris Lackey. You are the writers of today's show, so let's see what you have to say. First up, study number 69, Snow White.
Cole Karn says, anyone else feel like the mirror is kind of a dick here? Sure, the queen's jealousy isn't justification for murder, but the mirror's mean-spirited taunting certainly wasn't helping.
Eric Jordan Phillips writes, for real, 1,000 times more fair? Come on, mirror, how can we treat that objectively?
Dylan Winslow writes, sadly, there is no internationally accepted measurement for beauty. The best we have at the moment is the millihellen, which is the amount of beauty required to launch one ship.
I've never heard of that before, the millihellen.
It's a joke thing that's been around for quite a while. I don't know if it would be a mini Helen. I would think it would be a Helen.
Well, a Helen launched all of those ships. So a millihellen would be one ship.
Oh, I see.
Because a Helen launches a fleet of ships.
Oh, of course. Yeah, one Helen.
One Helen is 1,000 ships or however many.
The face that launched 1,000 ships. Yes, I get it.
I'm learning things here on the comments show.
Me too.
Jason Thompson writes, wow, good episode. I suppose you can really see the casual cruelty of pre-modern society in the way the villains get iced in these and other fairy tales. Some villain was evil? F***ing torture them to death in a public execution. Now that's justice. A straight line from this to Arnold Schwarzenegger sticking a steam pipe into a guy in Commando. There's a little more in Jason's comment, but stop. Jason, get to the closest university. I think you found a topic of dissertation that must be pursued. The straight line from Snow White to Commando. Give up Machmann Press and the comic book work you do, which I find excellent. But I think this is more important.
This is really important. Ex-Animus writes, does fair basically mean pale? Her name is Snow White, after all, so maybe the evil queen just wanted to be the palest in the land.
Oh.
If that's the case, her actions are totally justified.
That's true. Mark Simmons writes, well, if nothing else, this story demonstrates why the first thing you should check when someone stops breathing is that their airway is clear.
Yeah.
As for the story symbolism, is it just me, or does this fable incorporate a bunch of elements of the traditional look into a mirror on Halloween night and see your future husband ritual? There are versions of this where you're supposed to eat an apple or comb your hair, and I'm pretty sure I've heard one where you tighten your dress stays, too. It's possible that people lifted those elements from the Grimm fairy tale to establish a goofy party game, but the idea of ancient spells embedded in these fairy tales is kind of neat, especially when they eventually morph into Bloody Mary, which was how I learned that.
Yeah, me too. Carter Stepper writes, on the deer casket, this was a common practice for corpses of people who were especially holy and whose bodies were incorrupted, i.e. didn't decay. I assume the story is drawing on that tradition.
So if you were especially holy, you might be put in a casket that was clear. My question about that is, when did it ever work?
Yeah.
Like, aren't you just displaying that they really aren't that holy after all? Oh, man.
I guess so.
He's decaying like everyone else. That guy must have been a sinner.
Fortunately, one of the few cool things in my life that I could say I did was I got to see Lenin in the Soviet Union back in the day. I got to walk in and look at his body, which was in a glass coffin and was supposedly perfectly preserved.
Yes.
I'm guessing it was a wax replica of Lenin, but it sure looked like
Well, if it was the body, there would have been modern preservation things.
Yeah,
happening.
But even modern preservation wouldn't make you look like you were just sleeping still.
Lenin looked like he was just sleeping?
Yeah.
That's all the evidence I need. He didn't really die. That was a trick. Oh, my God.
I waited in line for like 2 hours to see it.
That's amazing.
A dead guy's body. And you know what? Totally worth it.
Well, I agree, especially with the revelations that are coming out on this podcast now. I was waiting for this podcast to be like podcasts in the movies. You know, they always are edgy, conspiracy-laced, obsessed hosts who uncover grand global schemes.
Mm-hmm.
What's Lenin up to right now?
Carter Stepper finishes off with one last thing. Have either of you read Fable? It's a comic series that puts the fairy tale characters in the modern world. Snow White plays a significant part.
Hmm.
I've read the first trade and I was interested, but not enough to keep reading it. And I know that there was a television show that was based off that, wasn't there? Wasn't it called Once Upon a Time?
There was a Once Upon a Time show. I don't know. Was that based off Fable?
Maybe it wasn't. I don't know.
Future comments. Send them along. Michelle writes, I personally was struck by how the evil queen tried to kill Snow White by using stereotypical symbols of beauty or feminine ideals. A corset, a comb. The only thing which finally worked with something beautiful on the outside but poisoned on the inside, just like the Evil Queen herself. Mm-hmm. Proof, the inner is more important than the outer, one might say. Hope I get the chance to read more fairy tales or other tales for the podcast. Thanks for having me on again. I think Michelle's fantastic, so we definitely will be having her on again.
Carter Stepper in again. Not to mention the apple being a common symbol for the fall of grace in Eden, i.e. the fruit Eve eats, the prototypical feminine failure.
Well, that always confused me. One person is afraid to eat an apple. Another person eats it. I'm going to hang out with the apple eater.
Yeah.
Would you ever hang out with somebody who's afraid to eat an apple? Ever? And me, you know how I feel about apples.
Yeah, I know. You love them.
I love them.
You love apples.
I dream that someday in the distant future, when all of civilization's works are mixed up and confused and conflated, that there will be a section in Genesis in which Eve gets a new boyfriend, Chad, and he likes to eat apples. Corey M. Wittig writes, I picked the Zipes translation up so I could learn the earliest versions of these tales and then adapt them to tell as oral stories to my students, mostly K through second graders.
Oh.
But I would often tell that same tale with more gruesome details to my middle school students with similarly positive results. Now that I've left the job, it's kind of easy to see I was pushing it, telling some of these scary stories to the little ones. But I must say they were always enthralled. Several times, kids who had experienced death in their lives would speak to me after a story about a personal loss, and I always took it as a positive thing that the telling of the story and all its gory details helped a kid feel safe in sharing their own run-in with death and despair. Which reminds me of something I often think about when hearing about how the Brothers Grimm collected these stories and published for a learned adult audience rather than kids. While it's true that the book wasn't meant for children, it was full of stories that had been told to kids. The friends of Jacob and Wilhelm who shared the stories were sharing stories they heard as children, right? So it's important to think of the purpose these scary details had for the kids who heard them. One thing is the cautionary element that is often mentioned, don't talk to strangers or sneak into homes that don't belong to you, etc. But I have to wonder if the bigger purpose wasn't just to share some really heavy truths of the world through story. Maybe in hearing about Snow White's trials, a kid who'd already experienced trauma could feel seen or understood in a way they hadn't been before. And some adult storyteller saying it to them shows the kid that the adult also knows how the world can be. So the kid listening and maybe relating doesn't feel so alone.
Hmm.
Great comment. And that's absolutely right. The book is called Children's and Household Tales, after all. I think that the Grimms presented these as chronicles of the culture, therefore not particularly thinking of the children's audience directly.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they presented the Morts and all, and it would be up to the adult to then adapt them for the audience of the children based on how old they are, just as Corey did for the different age groups in the class. But a point well taken that these are delivering some heavy truths in a world where adults are kind of trying to shine things up a little for kids because they know it's a terrible world out there. They want you to enjoy your childhood. So they're giving you some lies. These stories, on the other hand, confirm, you know, just because you're paranoid don't mean witches aren't going to eat you.
True that.
Yeah.
I got to say, telling my kids these stories, like the juniper tree, I didn't read it to them directly. I just told them the story. And of course, they were riveted. They couldn't believe it. They were just blowing their minds. And I completely relate to that because it blew my mind when I read it.
Yeah. Well, just from the point of view of it's unexpected.
Oh, yeah. It's just nutty. It's insane. Ario Jackwagon writes, I happen to know a bit about this story and the Grimm brothers and the period. And I have to say that your coverage of it is so good in the Chris and Chad way that makes me glad I subscribed.
Aw, thank you.
Darth Pseudonym writes, I wanted to make a comment about marriage age. You said that at 7, Snow White was potentially getting close to marriage age in medieval Europe, but that's not really accurate. The minimum marriage age for girls was generally reckoned at 12, not remotely close to 7, but historically, even that was rarely done. Royalty tended to marry significantly younger than average because of the political impact of such connections, while at the same time being more heavily reported on, so young royal marriages tend to skew our view. People were very much aware that young pregnancies are way, way more risky and didn't encourage them.
All true. I responded to this one in the comments at the time because talking about this stuff is such a quandary. Lord Pseudonym is correct. I actually said something very similar to this when we recorded, clarifying a bit that when girls generally got married off in the old days, they were usually older. But then while I was editing, I thought, man, I'm talking about this too much and it's creeping me out, you know? So I'll just leave it at 7's not too far from marrying age, which to me could mean up to 10 years, right? So I think it's just operational definitions there. Good enough. I'm going to run away from this topic now. But man, reading the comments again, that is some weird stuff that the prince came around at the end of the story and she's still 7 years old. I mean, maybe enough time passed to make her eight.
Maybe she was there for 5 or 6 years. We don't know.
Yeah, I guess so. Although if she is that young, it does clear up the horrific thing she does to the queen in the end, making her dance in the red hot shoes. Because at that age, suddenly vested with the power of being the queen, she's a little like the omnipotent kid and it's a good life.
Yeah, sure.
You know, he absolutely made somebody dance on their hot pumps before he sent him to the cornfield. That's something that kid did. I'm sure of it.
For sure. And that gets us into extra credit. Number 18, A Holiday Ghost Story. Steve wrote, "Where Did You Get That Hat?" is a comic song which was composed and first performed by Joseph J. Sullivan at Miner's 8th Avenue Theater in 1888. Bing Crosby included the song in a medley on his album 101 Gang Songs. From 1961.
Oh, okay. So when the water ghost in the story said, "Where did you get that hat?" which was a scuba helmet, and I didn't really understand why she was calling it a hat, but now I do. It was a pop culture reference.
Yep.
You have enriched it for me, Steve.
Pierce Duncan writes, "So he built a frozen hell and imprisoned her in it alone for all eternity. Reminds me of the scene in the Ghostbusters novelization where Winston looks inside the containment unit and sees a horrific limbo of lost souls."
What? If I had a nickel for every time. Ah, reminds me of the scene in the Ghostbusters novelization.
Wow. I'm a big Ghostbusters fan. I consider myself pretty high up there in Ghostbusters fandom. And that is a fact I did not know.
Well, you know, I read the Ghostbusters novelization because, you know, I liked those when I was a kid. Yes. But I don't remember that scene. That's really cool. I wish I still had it. I don't. Jason of the K writes, "Oof, asbestos-lined warehouse? I figure that would have been dismantled and removed sometime in the 1960s to the 1980s. By 2000 in the UK, for sure." That's the same in the US.
Uh-huh.
"Hope the new heir to the hall appreciates its annual visit." And I thought the same thing. He's so like, this capture is perfect. It's lined with asbestos. You'll never escape.
Mm.
Oh, there's going to be a sequel, I thought.
Nice.
Said it out loud. Nobody was there to hear it or care. Well, I hope that story helped moisten your holidays. Let's see if our next one added some nightmares to that. It's study number 70, The Juniper Tree.
Ola Romanu writes, "I think stories like this, with all the eating of one's own children, is perhaps society's way of reconciling something quite common in the animal kingdom. Animals often kill and eat their own spawn for any number of reasons. Even historical human cultures have countless stories of human infanticide. Maybe these stories are a way of trying to wrap our brains around that impulse. Besides, what parent hasn't felt cute aggression and said something like, 'I want to gobble you up'?"
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it's true.
Jason Thompson, contributing again, writes, "I'm trying to incorporate more fairy tales into the fantasy RPG I'm writing, but it's tricky because most of them are fundamentally about domestic disputes. There's crazy magic, but not as much epic plots or world building. So the question is how to involve PCs in these little dramas of inheritance and love and murder. It might work in a one-shot, but in a campaign structure, it's harder to imagine."
Mm.
That's true about the domestic disputes. We think about these magical fairy tale worlds, but the stories are just family members being mean to each other at the end of the day.
Yeah.
There's a direct line from this story to how Alyssa Milano is treated in Commando, I think. I hope to see more about that in Jason's dissertation. Mark Simmons writes, "As an adult, if you knock a kid's head off, you have a pretty good idea it was pre-cut." That's a quote from the show.
Yep.
A totally normal thing to say, Mark writes. "An episode so delightful, I died. But I got better." A couple of random observations on juniper berries, also the main flavoring ingredient of gin, a traditional beverage of my people. Yep. On parental grave trees, this comes up in the grim version of Cinderella as well. Rather than a fairy godmother, Cinderella gets her party bling from a tree that's grown up from her mother's grave. I didn't know that. Wow.
No,
in some versions, via birds that sit on it. Mom died, but she came back as a magic wishing tree. Must be one of those recurring motifs. We easily could have done another month on these. I mean, I would have loved to read Cinderella, so we'll definitely come back around to this.
I think maybe we're going to have next December, because people seem to love us doing the Grimms for December. Maybe next year, or this year, I guess we're in the new year.
We are.
We'll do December for Grimm stories.
It would be delicious.
Stuart Husband writes, "If you want a really interesting look at fairy tales in pre-revolutionary France, I highly recommend the first chapter of Robert Darton's book, The Great Cat Massacre. He covers some wild fairy tales in it, including one where a little girl has a doll that craps gold on command." crap, crap, my little doll. When a greedy neighbor steals the doll and tries to repeat the ritual, let's just say the results are rather more literal than he'd like.
Whoa.
Wow. That sounds awesome.
Great cat massacre, huh? I'm going to have to check that out.
Yeah, for sure.
Shayna Carter writes, did you know that Santa Claus has a cannibalism story?
Mm-hmm.
Well, St. Nicholas does. According to legend, around 1150, a butcher called Pierre Lenoir, or Peter Black, killed three children, chopped them up, and put them in a barrel of brine.
Mm-hmm.
7 years later, the hungry saint knocked at his door and asked for a meal, but unfortunately the only food Pierre had in the house was the barrel of salted kitties. In some versions, Pierre claims he has nothing to offer, while in others he actually serves St. Nicholas human flesh.
Whoa.
Either way, St. Nicholas miraculously resurrects the children.
Mm-hmm.
It's believed that Pierre Lenoir is one of the inspirations for Père Fouettard, Father Whipper or Father Flog, a bearded, whip-wielding figure who, in the Lorraine region of France, accompanies Santa and punishes bad children. Merry Christmas!
I've seen pictures of them. It's like kind of the Krampus sort of type of thing, except it's Pierre, you know, Leotard or whatever his name is.
Fouettard. I don't know if I'm saying that right.
Yeah, but I know the story about the resurrection of the children in the barrels, but I didn't realize there was a version of the story where he ate them, which is awesome.
I guess awesome's one way to describe it, yeah.
Victoria writes, I have a baby niece named Juniper, and I read the story thinking maybe it would be a sweet one to read to her. Nope. Thunk writes, for research, I've just tested this story on my six-year-old, and she was very pleased with it. Captivated. She informed me she will not make a stew out of me when I die.
Oh, that's nice.
That's great.
Chrome Fuse writes, evil stepsisters, evil stepmothers. I don't recall a single evil stepfather story. Is all the evil in these tales just based on inheritance issues?
Mm-hmm.
I loved this response. Sean writes, the Lost Boys movie has an evil stepdad and evil stepbrothers.
Oh.
It does, if you look at it through a certain lens. And then we conclude this episode with what may be my favorite comment of all time. Miss Charlotte Poe writes, do we ever know what Chad is talking about? Feedback number 18 from last month, Cabo Wabo and Wabby Shabby.
Steve writes, the best ever Scooby-Doo is Mystery Incorporated, which has two series, 52 episodes, and an overarching mystery. Some episodes are supernatural, some aren't. It also has a character called H.P. Hatecraft, voiced by Jeffrey Combs, and many nods to HPL.
Yeah, I've watched all of that. We've mentioned it a few times. It's great if you haven't seen Mystery Incorporated.
Josh Bell writes, Scooby-Doo on Zombie Island is, without an exaggeration or hyperbole, my favorite film of all time.
Wow.
It would make a fantastic bonus episode as a treat to yourselves, if nothing else.
I'm going to take that under consideration because I still haven't seen it.
I haven't seen it, yeah. I was... On that recommendation alone, I was getting ready to just purchase it on YouTube to watch it.
Oh, you're going to spend cash money on it. I think that comes with my HBO subscription, so I'm going to check it out as well.
Nice.
Study number 71, The Elves and Rumpelstiltskin. Jason Thompson's back and writes, I read somewhere that the changeling is supposed to be an adult fairy who just wants to live the easy baby life. Well, now that's relatable.
I get that.
Yeah, I'm on the changeling side now.
You don't even have to get up to go to the toilet.
You don't got
to
do any of that stuff.
Yeah.
There's no such thing as a verbal gaffe. You just go blah, blah, blah. People go, that's cute.
Drix writes, whenever elves and creepy fairies come in on the show, I'm always reminded of a great Terry Pratchett quote on the matter. Elves are wonderful. They provoke wonder. Elves are marvelous. They cause marvels. Elves are fantastic. They create fantasies. Elves are glamorous. They project glamour. Elves are enchanting. They weave enchantment. Elves are terrific. They beget terror. The thing about words is that meanings can twist just like a snake. And if you want to find snakes, look for them behind words that have changed their meaning. No one ever said elves are nice. Elves are bad. And that was from Lords and Ladies.
Rafe Ball writes, I may have to take issue with the claim that the shoemaker is poor through no fault of his own. When the customer comes in to buy the shoes the elves made, he buys them for twice the normal price, which is enough for the shoemaker to buy leather to make two more pairs of shoes. That means that normally he sells shoes at a price that allows him to buy enough leather to make one pair of shoes. In other words, he's selling his shoes at cost. Someone skipped economics 101. That's true. That is true.
He's a really bad businessman.
I assumed he just had too small of a margin, or that the market was saying your shoes are too crappy. Mm. It wasn't until the elves made it that he felt confident in double the price. But I think Rafe has an excellent point.
Nick Wassel writes, I was going to make a joke about the story with the younger godmother going missing for 7 years as being the source material for Flight of the Navigator, but actually it kind of is. I feel like the alien visitation and abduction stories have definitely taken the place of elves and gnomes and such in our modern folklore. And somewhere in the back of our minds is a need to have a small, mischievous, pseudo-magical beings running around behind the scenes of our society who we can blame for the bad and inexplicable things that go wrong with our lives. Also, I was just commenting the other day to my partner about how fat and glaring our young son's head and eyes are looking recently. So thanks for the tutorial on changelings. I did put some eggshells filled with water on the induction hob, but he looked very unimpressed. I guess they're wise to the technique these days. I love that that wasn't proof for you. That was you are convinced that your child is a changeling.
You're going to find the test that proves what you already have decided. It's bad science.
It's bad science.
Patrick Zisselberger writes, in the post-Leprechaun horror movie scene, Rumpelstiltskin was made into a bad horror movie where the evil little man is resurrected and plots to steal a baby in 1995 Los Angeles.
Oh, yes. I vaguely remember the cover of that at the VHS store.
Yes, me too. Chase Hansel writes, I am grateful you guys read my name after 4+ years of waiting. That said, couldn't you wait until next episode so it could be on the story about me?
Oh,
I'm very sorry, Chase. But you have nothing to complain about with a name like that. Chase Hansel.
Yeah.
Think of all the things you could be with a name like Chase Hansel.
Oh.
A magician, pop singer, politician.
International jewel thief.
International jewel thief. Nevertheless, we're saying your name before we discuss comments on the episode. Study number 72, Hansel and Gretel. And in that episode, I made mention of a house made of confectionery also being found in a 14th century manuscript about the land of Cockaigne. Aaron Campbell wrote, Cockaigne is a very interesting subject and one that is woefully overlooked in medieval studies. There are very few texts concerning it, which is probably due to the fact that Cockaigne existed solely for the benefit of the poor and dispossessed, just like other oral folktale traditions. It was in essence a secular heaven, or a fool's paradise, and embodied the topsy-turvy world where the lowliest amongst humanity occupied the highest positions of authority. It was said that in order to find the mythical land of Cockaigne, one first had to eat through a literal mountain range of custard. Oh, what a terrible fate. Once inside this land, roast pigs were said to wander the fields with forks sticking out of their backs, ready to be dined upon. Wow. Open your mouth and a cooked bird would fly into it. That sounds a little, I'm not into that. In fact, everything was edible. The king was the man who could fart the loudest, and work of any kind was a punishable offense. The medieval practice of the Feast of Fools has its origin in this mythology, and you can even see it echoed as late as the Great Depression in songs like the Big Rock Candy Mountain.
Ah, yes.
Yes, in that song, you know, cigarettes grow on trees and the river flows with whiskey. The hens lay soft-boiled eggs. From an early text, continuing with the comment, the land is, in fact, so filled with pleasure and delights that may be tasted of daily that there is no other place like it under the sun. Whether one's arrow hits the target or goes elsewhere, the winner is the first one who shoots farthest from the bullseye. And when there are races, the winner is always the one who comes in last. And it is also very easy to earn money there for those who are so lazy that they do nothing but sleep earn 6 pence for every hour they spend sleeping. Those who can let a reasonable fart earn 0.5 crown. I wonder if there's another book that gives you the specifics of what a reasonable fart means.
Eldritch Gollum, JPM, writes, really enjoyed this month of Grimm's fairy tales. Now I need to share with you my favorite thing about Hansel and Gretel, and that is the 1963 book Die Wahrheit über Hansel und Gretel, The Truth About Hansel and Gretel by Hans Traxler, which details the exploits of German primary school teacher and amateur archaeologist George Aussig, who uncovers the true crime behind this beloved fairy tale. Inspired by Heinrich Schliemann's discovery of the city of Troy using Homer's Iliad, Aussig began wondering if Grimm's fairy tales might not be based on a similar historical reality. In January of 1945, Aussig traveled to a small village of Steinau an der Straße in the German state of Hesse, where he began systematically surveying the nearby Spessart Woods, which are locally known as the Hexenwald or the Witch's Forest. Eventually, he discovered the remains of a 17th century bakery which had been destroyed in a fire. When the earth inside the remains of one of the bakery's 4 stone ovens was excavated, the charred skeleton of a woman was found. Consulting with local records, Aussig was able to discover that the bakery had belonged to a 35-year-old woman named Katharina Schraderin, who was famed for her gingerbread recipe. As it turned out, she had also been murdered after being accused of witchcraft by a rival baker named Hans Metzler and his sister, Greta, who were both adults, not children. This, then, is the true story behind the Grimm's tale.
Wow. Well, the comic continues, only it isn't, because George Aussig never existed. The author of the book, Hans Traxler, was a well-known Czech satirist who had written the truth about Hansel and Gretel in honor of the 100th anniversary of Jacob Grimm's death, and as a parody of the kind of work that real folklorists and archaeologists like Schliemann were doing at the time. The problem was that Traxler's satire was too good. Most readers and reviewers took the truth about Hansel and Gretel at face value, and the book became a bestseller in 1960s Germany on both sides of the Berlin Wall. Wow. The Marxists especially loved it because it was seen as evidence of the corrupting influence of capitalism. It was only when international scholars began contacting Traxler wanting to consult with Aseg that he was forced to come clean. Also in 1964, Traxler was sued for fraud, though his lawyers got the case dismissed by arguing that satire or parody need not announce itself as such, since to do so would ruin the joke. But it remains an amazing story about how badly we all want our favorite fiction to be, on some level, true. If you want to read more about this case, I recommend the 2019 Atlas Obscura article, How a Literary Prank Convinced Germany That Hansel and Gretel Was Real, which reproduces a number of the obviously faked photographs that appear in Traxler's book. We will link out. I can't wait to read that.
Yeah, that's awesome.
Thank you for all of that information, Eldridge Gollum. Tom Scullion writes, if you go out for dinner in a gentrified neighborhood, there is a decent chance you will be served pie on a roof shingle. I was grossed out by the edible house and going, would you eat something off a roof shingle? Yeah, you're probably right. That does seem like something that would be in some shishi restaurant. There were also some discussions about manipulators as good guys. I was wondering if there were any, and folks pointed out Bugs Bunny is. House from House MD is. That's definitely true, because he lies to his allies, even, and then you find out why he did it at the end. But you kind of don't like him. I don't know. I guess it is an anti-hero characteristic. There's also Face from the A-Team was pointed out.
Right. Yes. Brendan Gardner. Hey! Your old roommate and our dear friend writes, the bone Hansel was presenting to the witch as his own finger may have been that of a child she previously dined on, not that chicken or any other animal she'd have to labor to raise for food. That's what the candy house is for, to do the work for her. It's like the farm of the future.
That's true. Yeah. It could have been another child's finger bone, so she's not as dumb as we were making it out.
No.
REO Jackwagon writes, well, slap some burning iron slippers on your feet and tear yourself in half in anger. This has been a lovely Grimsumber. Thanks, hey. Chris, Chad, Heather, and Rachel. Happy holidays. Well, I hope you all enjoyed your holidays at the end of the year. If not, we got a brand fresh spanking new year for you. Yep. We're talking weird tales all this month, and hopefully you're enjoying that. Mm-hmm. We had a lot of fun with the Grimm tales, and I think Chris is right that we're going to try and do those again this holiday season.
Well, and with that, I'm Chris Lackey.
I'm Chad Pfeiffer.
And you've been listening to The Feedback Show.
On Strange Studies of Strange Stories.
Strange Studies of Strange Stories.